When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanners. So, let's be friends. Welcome to the third outing of Meet the Panel, where our illustrious revolving panel turned up armed with content and topics, and then we get to know them a little bit more personally as well. I pretend to care about their lives, so you don't have to. And it is a big one today. Today, we have the Will Riker of this space shed. Matt Trumpets is in the shed today, and a legit F1 journo tech man, Matthew Summerfield, as well. So this is definitely one you're not going to want to miss out on. Even if you're not a massive fan of Tech Time, I'm going to put them on the spot and make them actually explain what all those very long words mean. But we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. And here he is, the said Will Riker of the Starship Missed Apex Surprise. It's Matt Trumpets. How's it going, Matt?
You call that a tire pressure?
We're going to be unable to avoid tire chat, aren't we? If when I said bring a topic, you literally have come with a topic of tires and tire sidewalls.
Yes, I have.
Right.
But trust me, it's all in good fun. I embrace my parodyism.
But someone who is a stalwart of F1 tech journalism, and I don't care if he gets embarrassed, I think he is the absolute number one source for tech journalism in the entire F1 world. It's Matthew Summers, F1 Summerfield. Hello.
Hello. And yeah, I mean, 2024, new cars coming. Got to get excited, don't we?
Are they going to be substantially different?
Well, let's hope they're quicker, at least.
Well, okay. Why do you think that these current generation of cars are slow?
No, I mean, as in they catch up to a certain car that was a bit quicker than everybody else last year.
Okay, so we want 19 cars to be quicker and one to stop dead. And in fact, I think I'm going to ask this on behalf of the more casual fans, because of course I know. But in the middle of a regulation set like this, how realistic is it that there's any kind of substantial change from winter to spring?
Well, there's obviously some convergence, isn't there? So things that teams have spotted on other cars, things that they've learned throughout the course of the previous season. So there will be a chance for teams to catch up. At the start of a regulation set, you get a lot of field spread. So hopefully what we will see over the course of this year and maybe next year is that those teams all starting to bunch up again.
All right. But I'll start then by saying I have a topic to bring, a tech topic, because I don't normally get to quiz you two fine people. So this is to you as well, obviously, Trumpet. Everybody wants closer racing. Summers has just alluded to the fact that there is this kind of hope And not just a ham-fossy hope, a for-the-good-of-the-sport Paul de Resta-type hope that the racing will be closer. I think all F1 fans do wish for closer racing. How realistic is it ever in the tech space that we'll get the kind of close racing that F1 fans really want?
Oh, I think it is realistic. I don't think we have to go back too far before we had, like, what, 5 winners in 6 races?
2012.
Was that like the 2012
yeah, so
regulation?
So hang on then. That's over 10 years ago. Was it 11 years ago since we last had that kind of anyone can win at any time regs?
Yeah, well, I mean, when you're my age, that's not going back too far, to be fair to me.
No, that's true.
I think the issue is really the churn with the regulations, both the power unit and the aerodynamic regulations. The longer you have a set of regulations, the smaller the margins get. And we even saw this at the end of the last season. I think partially that was due to the penalty for Red Bull, but also it doesn't take teams that long to figure out sort of what the successful design is. And as Summers has already mentioned, convergence to happen.
So then why, Matthew Summerfield, if that is your real name, why do these regulations seem to change just as the convergence is happening? Is there a deliberate attempt to go, oh, they're all close again, let's mix it up? Or are they just constantly trying to solve problems and that's just how it happens to have worked out?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem that you have in many respects is that because of the way that the regulation sets work is that generally teams abandon development at very different stages. So the front teams start to abandon development very early compared to the teams in the midfield and at the rear of the pack. And so you tend to get this point whereby the rear teams start to close up to the pack purely because they're spending more development on their current car than the lead pack are. I mean, obviously there is convergence throughout the course of a regulation set, but towards the end of one, which is what we had in 2021, I think that's why we started to see a real pack, you know, the pack sort of closing up on one another. But that's not to say that it can't be done. I think if the regulation changes are handled in the right way, I think you could start to see some teams coming closer together. But as Trumpets has just alluded to, the trouble is every time we have a regulation set change, there tends to be the case that the front teams will go off into the distance, and it's more or less one team that does that better than another, and you end up with this sort of chase for the next 3 or 4 seasons for somebody to get back on level terms.
And just as they get back on level terms,
the cycle continues.
Well, one thing that I would like to address, I mean, there's a myriad of ways to help the pack close up. But fundamentally, being Formula One, we don't really want to penalize the front runners for being geniuses. What we want to do is make it easier for the midfield to catch up quickly. And one of the biggest things and one of the biggest problems, and I'm not the only one to point this out, is just gardening leave, which has now been baked in by the FIA, but it limits the transfer of knowledge between teams. There's always been gardening leave, but it's sort of been standardized to the point where if I were to hire, as we've seen people going to Williams, Pat Fry, his impact on that team from him being hired to actually making a difference to the team is going to be at least 18 months. And that's problematic when your entire regulation set is only 6 years. So there's one easy thing to fix for the FIA is make it easier for senior members and for members in general to move between staffs so that the teams can benefit from that knowledge sooner.
But just instantly that will create like a wage war. So I suppose it depends whether those people's wages come under the cost cap. Because wouldn't that just be like a bidding war if there was no gardening leave summers? People would just be in there with like manila envelopes full of money and like, oh, maybe you can stay in my apartment during the summer. It's got its own pool and it's in Costa Brava. That's the poshest place I could think of under pressure. There's probably way posher places. Skegness, for example. Would Matt's idea solve the issue of catch-up?
It would have some limited impact. Obviously, as you've mentioned, the other issue is the way that this all butts up against things like the cost cap and the way that the development arc of a team already works. Something along the lines of perhaps what McLaren did last season, sort of goes against the grain of what we would traditionally expect to happen with the cycle of development, for argument's sake. But yeah, I mean, it would be beneficial in many ways to be able to have that freedom of movement between staff without a gardening leave. But I do also see the reasoning behind why that has been a mechanism in the past as well, especially with the protection of IP within certain parts of companies, etc. But yeah, I mean, it's just one problem or issue that Formula One faces and will always be a moving goalpost.
Well, to me, the whole reason we have this standardized like it is because of the Haas-Ferrari situation. So the issue isn't a Red Bull senior engineer going to McLaren or Mercedes or Ferrari. The issue would be a whole bunch of Red Bull engineers going to AlphaTauri for the period of like 3.5 weeks during when they do most of their wind tunnel testing, and then happily scooting right back to Red Bull afterwards. So this is where the gardening leave came from. I'm just saying a sensible approach to it would allow knowledge to be spread more rapidly amongst the teams, so the catch-up time takes less.
But why would you spend all that time like developing these things? Like, you're in a little club and you think that like Derek and Jeff are your Bezzy head engineers, and then Jeff gets off with that timeshare in Birmingham City Centre. That's where Summers is from, so he thinks that's posh. If you know they can be poached that easily, then there's no incentive to develop hard. So we kind of have to ask ourselves, what do we actually want? Because what I think the fans want, all the things that we're looking for, go towards a spec series. And longer regulation sets, mean that things would converge as if it was a spec series. But I suppose the last thing the teams want is to spend all that money just to have it basically be a spec series.
All right, fine. I'll go first. I don't think it would ever get to that level. And Summers has been, if you go back and listen to our tech shows, he's been very clear about this, especially once we started to see pictures of the floor of the Red Bull and stuff like that.
I listened to all of them twice. Yeah. Twice I listened to that particular one. That you.
Yep. Nope. Yep. We completely believe you 100%. No. And the thing is, just having the knowledge of what another team is up to isn't guaranteed to actually improve your car in the slightest. Doesn't matter to me if I know how Red Bull works its floor. If my suspension is in a place where I can't use that design, that knowledge is effectively useless to me, at least for that season. And then even if I do change this design, and I will simply point to a certain formerly pink and now green team has done this several times.
Allegedly.
That if you don't fully understand that concept, then when things do change, mid-regulations, when they make tweaks and adjustments, like raising diffusers and this and that and the other, then what you get is you lose all of your forward progress because you don't really understand the concept you're working with. You've just copied it.
I get where Matt's coming from with the gardening leaf thing, and I do think it would be a good idea to revisit that side of things, especially because of the way that it was dealt with to prohibit what went on between certain teams. Allegedly, let's say.
Thank you.
We don't want any lawyers involved, do we, Spanners?
To be honest, with a lot of this stuff, like when it's true, like I don't panic. If someone says something that's, oh, it's controversial, but I reckon it's true, like I just say, go for it. Like Ferrari regulations that ended up in them facing for the 2019 season. People always go, oh, you can't say that, but it's a thing that happened. So I bring it, I say. Name the team, Summers. You're the only one with FIA accreditation, so you're the only one with anything to risk.
Anything to lose, yeah?
That's the one.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, the gardening leaf thing needs to be revisited, and hopefully that will be dealt with when we make the shift for 2026. That's obviously when the next major regulation change is coming into place. And I think that we need to not only address things in 2026 from an aerodynamic point of view, from a power unit point of view, but also from a sporting point of view. And obviously this falls under that, along with things like the cost cap, because I think teams will have started to prod on that and make inroads that weren't necessarily part of what the FIA wanted the cost cap to have in place in the beginning. So I think all of those sort of things need to be addressed.
Ironed out, like tax rebates.
Yeah, we need to find the level ground and start again in many ways with certain parts of the regs.
Now, you are a very interesting man, Matthew Summerfield, and you do great tech work. And when I look at the other F1 journalists in different fields, your chosen speciality is objectively harder to do. You know, all your diagrams, the amount of work, the amount of research that's involved in it is harder. And then Matt, when he does the Tech Times and has a really like a great enthusiasm as a fan of the F1 tech and produces Tech Times, the notes for that show, it's a lot harder than what I do, which is like, whose fault do you reckon that crash was then? So like the tech side is so much harder, but I think my stats bear this out as much as you'll see stats from places like motorsport.com and Autosport. It's just a less popular angle to Formula One. A, that's a shame, but why do you think the tech side doesn't have the same mass appeal as who Leclerc is dating?
Well, I think it does in some ways. From a stats point of view, if we're riding a piece that has some authority, like when a team has done something incorrectly,
right,
or when there's a new development gone on a car or something along those lines, then yes, we will get a lot of eyeballs on those particular articles. However, as you say, from the bulk of it, you do struggle in terms of generating eyeballs on content. And that is purely down to the fact that Formula One fan base is very tribal, I seem to
except
find.
And
you
us.
Find, yeah. You find that in every single sport, don't you?
Yes,
you know,
of course.
At the end of the
day,
people follow the sportsman rather than the collective in many disciplines. Obviously, there are certain disciplines where that is less so, like football or soccer as well.
Or rowing or kabaddi, yeah.
But yeah, I do think there is a space for it. But as you've mentioned, sometimes you have to admit the fact that space is subject to the particular thing that you're looking at. So we have to go hard on certain subjects because we know that those will generate, you know, a spike in traffic. And other times you are doing certain things just because it's the run of the mill and you need to cover that stuff anyway.
So we were having in the last show, a discussion about why the Constructors' Championship isn't seen as kind of as sexy or as high profile. And I think it was Alex who was suggesting, well, what if you make, you know, more of a fuss about who's on the front left jack? You know, let's have a top trump card of people who are the tire changers and stuff like that. So, do you think maybe F1 doesn't quite do a good enough job opening itself up to the engineers and getting to know the people who are, you know, working on the day to day suspension elements, Matt? Do you want an interview with suspension Derek at McLaren?
I would love to hear from Matt Harmon, responsible for a lot of the technical design of the Alpine, for example, where many teams have been copying from. And I know this because I read Summer's articles in motorsport.com. I would love to hear that. But, you know, this is an interesting thing because I'm going to bring this up. You two live across the pond from me. And because of that, I watch a different Formula One TV than you do. I watch F1 TV for my race coverage, which features Sam Collins.
Yep.
Who's a really good engineer. They featured Tina Gade, who is the sister of Lena Gade, also an engineer recently. And with Alex Brundle being on there too, they get into some fairly technical content. And I do really quite enjoy that. So I get some of that.
That's
from the
interesting.
TV coverage.
And that's F1 TV.
That's F1 TV. Now, I know you do get a Ted's Notebook, and I've always, one of the things that I've loved about Ted when I've been able to see the show is that he will oftentimes do that thing that I like to do, which is to go back and say, here are all the teams. What are the questions we had about the race? Can I get some answers to them? And aside from his proclivity for just naming everything a barge board,
that's an
he
old meme.
He will get into some more technical stuff.
That is a dead meme.
But it's been a while since I've seen it, so okay, I don't have any new ones to go off of. I think the F1 TV and Liberty could make more.
Yeah, that's interesting. It is Ted, isn't it, who does a lot of the tech? But I think because you can opt out of Ted's Notebook because it's, you know, after the race, and they throw to him every now and then. But in the pit lane, he kind of gets used as a pit lane reporter rather than as a out-and-out tech reporter. So, you know, he's the eyes and ears down on the ground, which is really valuable. But, for example, Sky Sports have Bernie Collins there for the strategy element of it. Maybe they need a Matthew Summerfield alongside. Maybe you can be their Sam Collins. So maybe if they had a bit more of a leaning to those that tech angle, but you don't really have lots of opportunity during the race to go, ah, that's because the front suspect. I mean, what do you think you would have good impact or good input live during a race, or is it all before and after?
I personally think that there is space for it during the course of a broadcast. And I know that Mark Hughes worked alongside Sky Sports for a while in the commentary box with Crofty and Brundle to offer support in that respect. And I think that might be something that they've perhaps missed recently, is having that information fed to them in terms of knowing some of the more technical details. Obviously, Brundle is very, very good at that side of things. But there is more room, as Matt's mentioned, to have somebody on board perhaps that will help there.
Well, it would help. There's a lot going on. Like, I know when Alex Brundle has done commentary in the past, it just as a driver, he's very into the technical side. So he will give insight. But I think the larger issue about having that sort of commentary in general is tech itself has a bit of a learning curve to really appreciate. And if you normalize that coverage and you start explaining those things when everybody, even your casual fan, is watching, then you increase everybody's appreciation of what's really happening on the racetrack. And it's more incredible than most people know.
Or you tune into Tech Time on Missed Apex podcast. Now, I've got a request from you two Tech Time people. If I promise to behave myself, please can I be the voice of the dum-dums who don't always understand everything on the 2024 Tech Time episodes?
Of course.
Oh, no, that took too long for him to say that.
There was like a pregnant pause there, wasn't there?
That was Zoom delay. That was Zoom delay. I'm very welcome. Matt will still be in charge. But a lot of the time I'm producing those anyway. So I'm just going to be there so I can occasionally go, Matt, I don't know what a phalange is. Please tell Summers to stop saying tire squirt.
Would you like us to explain anti-squat and anti-dive to you?
I regret it already. You are listening to a kind of special Tech Time-ish edition. Yes, we're going to be talking about tech subjects, but this is part of our winter content where I'm bringing, like Spanner's Arc, I'm bringing my panelists on two by two, armed with subjects to talk to us about. So, of course, Chris came in with the very, very popular Corner Names podcast. Please stop emailing me for part two. We are going to do a part two. I asked for 20 people to get in touch. I think it's ticked over 300 at the moment, and I'm going to stop counting. So please, please, please stop. We are going to do it towards the end of February. Before the start of the season, there will be a Corner Names part two, and it will be your fault. Of course, we also did the World Constructors Championship show, somewhat less successful, but it was a brave effort. We tried to make people care about the World Constructors Championship, and I don't think, judging by the comments, that we succeeded. But my favourite part of all of these bits of content has been getting to know the panel. So towards the end of the show, we'll veer away from Formula One. And for example, I might look at Summers and go, there's a little trophy in his background. He's very proud of it. So we might chat a little bit of golf and living on a windy, stray island with Matthew Summerfield. And we'll talk a bit of trumpeting with Matt Trumpets and find out how he earns his whiskey money. Now, Summers has come armed with a topic which you're going to enjoy, which you will enjoy. I demand it. But I'd like to extend an invitation first. So, are you a keen iRacer? Because we are about to start Season 8 of our iRacing tournament. So, we have 6 events over 6 months. Each has 3 races racing single-seater races on iRacing. If you're interested, get in touch, racecontrol@mistapex.net, or you can click the entry link in the show notes below. We charge 25 quid for the whole season, and each event includes a couple of practice nights as well. So you'll be on Discord with the likes of me and Matt, have a chat with us, have a race with us. You don't have to be good. I'm going to make that clear. If you had to be good, you wouldn't get me and Matt on, for one thing. But all we ask is that you sort of practice enough to just be safe and not take anyone out. And if it makes you feel any better, there isn't a single person in that entire grid who hasn't wiped me out of a race. I'm like a magnet to people wiping me out of the race. So if you want to have a fun, chilled out, but taken, you know, semi-seriously and done professionally, iRacing series, then get in touch, racecontrol@mistapex.net. All right, Summers, what are you coming at us with? What tech delights have you brought in your hamper?
Well, kind of the theme for what we were talking about here was how we might fix Formula One.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I have banged a drum about for a number of years now is DRS.
Yes, right. This has got to be one of the most controversial topics in Formula One. And the thing is, I end up defending DRS because I am older than I care to admit, and I've watched an awful lot of non-DRS races in Formula One. Obviously, like all of us here, I've watched much more non-DRS races than DRS races. I remember the problem it was solving, and I remember how much of almost a relief it was when it first came in, but now it's been much derided as being too artificial. So too artificial in a sport that has been constructed completely by people and made up from the ground up. So I will remind everyone in the context of this chat that Formula One cars don't fall naturally from trees. They aren't picked from a field or hunted in a savannah. Yet DRS is the thing that's too artificial. So Summers, I'm currently understanding of DRS. I'm a friend of DRS. Are you?
Yeah, I mean, as like yourself, I find that I constantly have to defend DRS as a mechanism to engage in an overtaking situation. Like yourself, I'm a person that's
had old
experience prior to DRS. Yeah, basically I'm old. And we know the pain of watching lap after lap of somebody following somebody and being unable to overtake.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're not saying DRS is perfect, but if you think DRS trains are boring, buckle up, because non-DRS trains are even more boring.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with non-DRS trains is that you really need somebody in front of you to have a failure for you to then overtake them. That's kind of how it used to happen in sort of the 80s and 90s. But in terms of DRS, I understand why people have a massive bugbear with it. When it first came in, it was heralded as more of a sticking plaster for a problem that we would resolve. We'd kick the can further down the line and we'd sort that out with a new set of regulations further on. And I think people kind of accepted that to start with, but now we are over 10 years into using DRS and there looks like no sign of that actually going away.
When did it start? When did it start, DRS?
2011.
Is that it?
Because we
had like it's older than that.
the F-duct in 2010, which was sort of the precursor to DRS. It kind of opened up that channel in the mind of everybody as to what could possibly be. In terms of an overtaking aid.
But when was KERS part of Formula One, that energy button where you could press the button and get a little bit of a boost? When was that?
2009. Not all teams had it in 2009.
Oh, that's right. Not everyone could have it. And how long did KERS last as like a button?
6.67 seconds from memory.
Oh, I meant in seasons. Sorry.
Oh, in seasons.
I meant like how long did
KERS lasted until 2013.
Right.
And then the new power units came in 2014.
Ah, that's it, and it's
and
gone.
Obviously that brought with it a new energy recovery system.
Let's find out where Trumpets is on this, because we're both being DRS apologists.
Well, where I am is there's perfect and there's good.
Mm.
And I think DRS falls into the good category because it does make more racing possible. And especially it reduces the delta in performance needed to overtake someone in front. So, you know, we talk about other series. One of the best things about IndyCar, it's a spec series, but you have amazing racing because there's not big differences between the cars. So overtaking happens, but also their entire rule set which we were talking about earlier, makes essentially it almost outlaws defensive driving. If they think you're driving in your mirrors, you'll get a penalty for that.
Oh.
So it puts the emphasis on overtaking rather than defending. Now, Formula One is a different sport. I'm not arguing it should go that far, but you know, I'm going to sit here and suggest that everyone at the FIA sit up and pay attention when Summers explains, which he will do right now, how DRS could be even closer to perfect than it currently is.
He will explain that, but not because you told him to. He wants to.
He would have done that regardless.
He would have done it anyway, Matt.
Yeah, in a different timeline, this conversation never happened, and I'd already made my point. yeah, I mean, basically, I've kind of alluded to the way that I think Formula One should perhaps take a look at using DRS differently for a number of years now. And my approach to it is that most people deride DRS because it is something that cannot be defended against. Mm. So a driver can't survive an attack via DRS for very long, unless you're in a train, because obviously then everybody has the DRS. And this, I believe, would resolve the problem of the DRS train as well. In my opinion, there should be more strategy to how you deploy DRS. Now, there's two ways that you could do that. You could either have a timed implement, or you could have a number of presses implements,
yeah,
and use it as an attack or defense. And that way, then the drivers themselves can decide how much that they want to use DRS. It would reduce the amount of DRS trains, because you can't simply just keep pressing the button, because you've only got a certain number of minutes, seconds, or numbers of presses per race. Me and Trumpets have had a discussion about this in the past. You could extend that beyond just the race and have it over the race weekend, and then you bring in even more strategy. But I do think that there is a mechanism for DRS that could offer better racing, not only from the fact that you then take away the fact that people think that this is just a band-aid solution, but also from the fact that it is now defensible by the lead driver who's being attacked by another. And for me, that would open up some more possibilities.
Okay, so the limited amount of presses almost makes it like a boost button that you can press when you want. So this push to pass. So obviously we could create the same effect with an extra store of electrical energy. So what you're basically creating is KERS, but with the DRS, and you can do it a limited number of times. Now, remember the rule here on Missed Apex podcast, me doing go-karts or sim racing counts as exactly the same as being a Formula One driver. I will hear no argument against it, but we were doing Formula Renault 3.5 in our last season of the Missed Apex iRacing Cup, Matt, and we had 8 presses of it over 16 laps. What did you make of that? Because I got a little bit frustrated with it, where, you know, we were kind of just making progress, or I'd overtaken a car that was not really in a fight with me, but I found myself behind, I overtook them, and then they would use their DRS to come back at me, or they would use the DRS to pointlessly kind of cling on to a position when they were all over the place, and you kind of go, no, let's work together, let's save our DRS presses. And then, you know, you get later in the race and then you come up against someone who didn't have to fight through the field and they've got infinite DRS presses. What did you make of that system?
Well, I'm not sure in my racing with it that it ever made that much difference to me. I mean,
no, you were in the crash barrier.
Pit out laps. Yeah, the 3.5, if we'd had it in the F3, it would have been perhaps more interesting from a strategic point of view. But I think when you're talking about Formula One drivers who are professionals combined with people who are strategy engineers, I think you're going to get you would see some pretty interesting configurations of it, in terms of, especially if you drop the rule that you have to be within a time limit of the person ahead.
Oh yeah,
you'd have to. If we do that, then suddenly my choice to use DRS is going to be based on more than just, am I trying to overtake that person ahead of me? The other thing that I think has really gone missing, for the most part, we see it some, is in the early days of DRS, they would be very free with changing the limits of how long it was and where the things taken. It's much more entrenched now. So sometimes when it works out right, it winds up giving you really good racing. But it seems like they're not as I would use the word nimble about making adjustments during the race weekend. And I don't really know why that is.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Shall I bake your noodle even further?
Let's do it.
In 2011, and I think it was 2012 as well, we had unlimited DRS in qualifying. The reason I believe that DRS was taken away from an unlimited version was because Red Bull were able to go through 130R with the DRS wide open, and nobody else could, but everybody else started to try it and suddenly realised how much downforce that the Red Bull actually had. And the following season, it was totally binned. So, yeah, there was a mechanism behind why it was done, but I do miss that. It was another
strategy point. Why do you miss that, though? Because surely if everyone can just open it all the time, it's the same as it not being open all the time in qualifying.
Well, I don't know. I think there was nuances in the driver's abilities to be able to use DRS in certain parts of the circuit that other drivers can't, because either because of their skill level, let's say, or because their car had more downforce and they could run into and out of certain corners that other drivers couldn't. So I think it added a different element to things, and also it meant that the teams had to rethink how they set their car up for qualifying and the race, because obviously the DRS then had different meanings whether you were on unlimited DRS in qualifying or whether you were set up for a race scenario.
So I was actually, because I had advance warning that you wanted to talk about this. This is one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot. And I'm just curious to get your take. And I guess Spanner's too. What would you think of giving a timed amount of increased fuel flow without changing the absolute amount of fuel that you could bring on board?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if we think back to party modes and those sort of scenarios, I think we were operating in a similar realm to that in the past. I would also argue that you could probably do similar things in terms of the energy recovery systems as well, because we have to remember how mature this power unit regulation set currently is. This will be its 10th year. I know we introduced these power units in 2014. We're now in 2024. We're not going to see the back of them until 2026. I still think there's a huge amount of margin for the development side of things, although obviously we're under certain caps. But I do think that there is some margin there to unleash the power units in certain respects, especially during qualifying. I mean, for me personally, qualifying should be about the car being at its most alive during the course of a race weekend. It should basically be, right on the edge. The driver should be throwing it around you've never seen before. But we don't tend to see that quite as much as we used to, because the drivers are thinking about reliability concerns. They're thinking about other sessions they might be involved in. My favourite topic, sprints being one of those. And all those sort of things. So I do think though that there is margin for the power units to be used a little better.
Well, the thing that I wanted to get to, the thing that struck me is limiting this to the internal combustion side. So you could use more fuel for your internal combustion, but you had no more fuel you could use during a race. So as we all know, no Formula One car goes in with their tank full. So you would have to make a trade-off between how much fuel do you put in for to be able to use the button for the maximum amount of time versus how much advantage do you gain by having a lighter car. And I think that could lead to some very interesting strategic choices and racing. But that was what I was thinking.
So you're thinking like they can fuel save in the race. So they're like, you've done the fuel saving, now you can press the magic button now.
Yeah, they already do that, but they don't have extra fuel flow to use.
Right,
they're
right.
limited. Is it like 100, 105 now?
Yeah. I will throw a monkey in the wrench or a monkey wrench in the works.
Thanks for not saying spanners in the works. I appreciate that.
In as much as the engineers will try to subvert that situation as much as possible. Purely because if you think of pit stops in the past, at one point we used to think, oh yeah, there's loads of pit stops in this race because, you know, we didn't have a more sound understanding of what that actually meant in terms of overall race time. And I think that's where they might be limited in thinking, well, we won't put the fuel in because we won't be able to make up that deficit that we'll use or spend with the extra fuel on board for those power laps or those, you know, those seconds during a power lap. So there might be a good mechanism to put that in place, but I think you have to really be quite strict in how you would apply it in order to get the best from it. And again, then you're adding regulations. And as we know, the more regulations you add, the more controversy you end up with because teams then start to push the boundaries of what those regulations actually mean.
And that means more DTS viewers and more sprint races, right? This is exactly what you want. I want to follow up a little bit more if I could. When you mentioned unleash the power unit, like which restrictions are you looking at now that you would like to see gone or maybe just gone during qualifying?
Well, as you mentioned, I think that there is a mechanism whereby you could actually have a different arrangement for qualifying than you have in the race, because the power units are so mature now and they are so utterly reliable that you could push them a little bit beyond the boundary of where we currently lie. So you could perhaps say during qualifying, well, you've got so much more energy recovery system, you know, you can use so much more power through the MGUK as we're proposing for 2026 anyway, and so on and so forth, just to get more out of the power unit and the car for qualifying over a race condition. I mean, they are obviously doing that in some respects anyway, because they'll meter their usage during a race. But I do think there's more available if we just push the boundaries on the regulations a little bit to open or free things off, seeing as we're so far into a regulation set on the power unit.
Oh, well, I mean, the news coming from Autosport is the power units, and I know you read all of these, so I can't. Apologies, I don't know who wrote this. Hang on, was it you? There was an Autosport article saying that from now on, F1 power units should be more road relevant. And I'll try and find that, whether that was a quote from, I think that was from F1 rather than, you know, Derek in the tech journalism department. But I have some issue with that, especially with road relevance going purely towards electric. Being road relevant surely just means an electric power unit. And why is road relevant solely pushed on the engine? Why not boot space? Why not having enough room for your golf clubs? Why don't the drivers have to put in one of those 3-point safety things of a child seat? Yeah, that's road relevance, isn't it? Imagine that, Verstappen and Hamilton having to strap in a 4-year-old.
4 wheels in a child seat.
Yeah.
And slow things down.
everyone gets a toddler that just will not sit in the child seat, has somehow decided they won't be in a seated car today. So road relevance is just an odd one for me, you know. Like, is there a plan to market cars with infinite downforce that can drive upside down in tunnels? Like, it's a nonsense to say the sport should be road relevant in just one specific area.
This is the problem. I don't understand where road relevance has any tangible connection to Formula One. Yes, to World Endurance Cars, yes, to Rally in some respects and to other series. But for Formula One, although there is a trickle down in terms of the technology transfer over time, I don't believe that there is realistically a connection. I mean, when was the last time that you went out on the road in an open-wheeled car with downforce and 1,000 horsepower?
Wait, you know, does that include my Nova in 1998? Because it did have a spoiler, my lime green Vauxhall Nova.
How much downforce was it pushing?
Loads.
Spoiler.
Really stable rear end. Yeah. But that was mostly due to Fat Eddie, who'd always sit in the back.
Did it have 1,000 horsepower as well?
It did not have 1,000 horsepower. It had maybe like 60.
Yeah, so there you go. I mean, road relevance to me and Formula One, yes, there is some kinship in terms of trickle down over a long period of time, but certainly not a direct correlation. And I don't think that regulations should be framed with that in mind, because in reality, that there is very little to connect to.
And that's an issue, I think. If you ask me about road relevance, I think that suspension really, especially active suspension, would be where we saw a lot of it. And if you ask me to design a regulation set that would have road relevance, here's what I would tell you: torque vectoring and front axle recovery.
Which were binned by the FIA and...
Yep.
FOM, when those were brought up and talked about as a mechanism to be brought into future regulations, because they didn't fit the bill of Formula One. So, as you mentioned, there is no real direct connection between the two.
I have found the article. I'm a hero. It is by your friend John Noble, and it's from the FIA, then, this statement. It's the FIA's head of single-seater matters, Nicholas Tombazis, who says, did I say that right? Tombazis. Yep. I like it. It's a good name. Says, what is critical is having rules that offer value to manufacturers. The step for 2026 is defined, but what we do in the next step afterwards is up for discussion. There are a lot of options still on the table, whether it's more sustainable e-fuels, whether it's hydrogen, shut up, in which case we have a lot of work happening in the FIA, or whether it's more electrical. That is quite a worrying statement, because that is just knocking racing down the ladder in terms of priorities. And to be honest, if he's saying he's looking at hydrogen as in a, when's the next regulation set after this one in like 8 years time, if he thinks that the hydrogen is going to be road relevant and he's in charge, to me, that's worrying.
I think it's a blanket appeal statement, though, just to say, look, we're looking at all these areas and okay. We know that these things are being looked at in terms of road relevance. So we have to have some of that incorporated into
That's
development.
True. He does mention a lot of different ones. So he isn't specifically saying hydrogen, to be fair. But even like this move to sustainable fuels is driving me mad, because you're not going to have a road network fueled by sustainable fuels.
No, there isn't the mechanism in place to do so at the moment. But I do think that Formula One has led in many respects for that side of things. But again, it's something that I think you're kicking the can down the line, and they're putting out a statement because they know that a regulation set has been formed for 26. Yeah. And now we're really starting to think about the next set of regulations beyond that, which will probably be 2030, 2032.
So I mentioned suspension. If I'm a manufacturer, just like when I come over for Mist Apex, I need some connection to be able to write things off of my taxes. You have to, as the FIA, give the manufacturers a nod and enough, because let's face it, without manufacturer support, the sport looks a lot different and maybe not nearly as fast or fancy. It is a bit of a devil's bargain, I'll give you this. In reality, I'm actually going to bring up a long time ago, I rented a car that was a hybrid. It was the first hybrid car I ever drove, and you could choose to do regeneration on braking. And the first time I did that, the thing just about broke my neck.
Was it a Prius?
No, it was a Honda version of a Prius. But yeah, essentially the same idea, not as refined. This is a long, long time ago, because of course I'm very, very old. And so now you look at how so much time and money is spent by Formula One teams working out this brake-by-wire stuff in the rear where the regeneration happens. A lot of the software and the energy management software And I think probably wiring looms and stuff like that too, really does have a fair amount of relevance to road cars, which is why we see it included in the sport. But to me, this is just like a public relations gesture by the FIA. Oh,
I think you're right.
Now.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
We're just going to include enough of it to keep you happy so you can continue to to spend money in the sport and get away with it with your various relevant national tax authorities.
Yeah. So I think you're right. Like, I've just read the whole article there while you're talking, and he does look like he's trying to appeal to everyone because you have to mention hydrogen or you get the nut jobs who are wrong about it. And if you want proof of that, please check out the YouTube comments below for validation that the hydrogen crew are still pouring in there. But yes, he's clearly just trying to please everyone. And I think this is the issue to me, Matt, is that a lot of this really is lip service. A lot of the net zero stuff looks a bit wishy-washy to me. A lot of the sustainable fuels feels like, what's the word? Is it green? It's not greenwashing, but it's
there or thereabouts. I mean, a lot of the sustainable stuff that was low-hanging fruit has been nixed on safety reasons. So you would have reason to believe that. But things like the 100% biofuels, that doesn't really have a huge application in individual passenger cars. But if I'm Petronas or if I'm Shell, I might be selling some version of that as aviation fuel, because there it does have an application, or as marine fuel.
That's air relevance. That's not road relevance.
But understand that these big fuel petroleum companies are engineering partners with these teams.
So, yeah.
So like, I at least I find that an arguably useful connection.
Okay, Summers, I'm unburdening you of such concerns. I'm unburdening you of road relevance or pretending to be environmentally aware whilst driving race cars on planes that zigzag across the world as if your flight path is stitching the continents together, you know, as a whole repair. It's like darning a sock, isn't it? The flight path of the F1 schedule. But okay, I'm going to unburden you of all of that. How do we actually unleash the power units?
As I've already mentioned, I think you have to basically boost what we currently have from the 2014 power unit we've developed, you know, a great deal from what we had when they first arrived. Certainly from Renault's point of view, which exploded every 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And my biggest argument with the fact of what we're doing for 2026 is trying to encourage new manufacturers to come on board. Formula One is a bit of a closed shop in many respects. Mm-hmm. And we've only got so many teams. We've already obviously had the likes of Andretti say that they want to come on board. They're now trying to renegotiate with Renault. There's talks of obviously other manufacturers coming in and to take over, like Ford with Red Bull. But the current power units themselves, everybody mentioned that there was going to be a massive pain to get on board with what that current technology was. Honda, yes, they might have taken a little longer, but they also came in without the knowledge that the other manufacturers had previous to that for 3 years that they'd been developing those regulations. So I'm not so sure that there was a problem with the current set of regulations in terms of being able to develop this type of power unit. So I think what we're getting in 2026 is something a little bit watered down in many respects from a technological point of view compared to what we have now, and might not necessarily be a bad thing. But from my point of view, I think because we've had these regulations for such a long period of time, I think there's some headroom to be able to take the fuel flow and take the energy recovery systems to another level. But you know, will that happen over the next 2 years? Probably not, unfortunately.
I would settle for an agreed upon mechanism for equalizing the horsepower.
But then what's the point?
For teams that have fallen behind, I think it's pretty valid, actually, because we have a large discrepancy right now amongst the power units, which we did not previously have before the cap came into place.
Would I argue here that somebody likes a certain team that has a power unit that's a long way behind the rest?
Is that affecting anyone's driver that they're a fan of in particular?
Well, I don't think it's affecting the driver so much, but it's affecting the team. And I think more importantly, and the reason I do bring it up is because this is already under discussion amongst the power unit manufacturers, is a way to open these doors when anyone, you know, if I was Ferrari, I would have appreciated that. And what was it, 2018, 2019? Would have been nice to be able to fix some stuff then.
Okay. Well, I'll grant you your wish. Equal, we'll find a way for all equal horsepower, as long as we also have equal downforce points. What's the difference? Why don't we limit or equalize the amount, total amount of downforce teams can have summers? Why are engines different from aero development?
They're not. I don't agree per se with where Matt's going. I agree with the fact that there needs to be some development allowed. I don't think it needs to be completely unrestrained. But the problem is that fundamentally this is an issue that Renault have carried for a very long time because they were so far behind the curve. And they had ample opportunity to catch up, just as Honda did. Mm-hmm. They managed to overcome these problems in a shorter period of time than Renault did, effectively. So I do think that, yes, there should be some allowances made, especially for Renault, who have found themselves adrift in some respects. But they did have ample opportunity to do this before things were locked down.
I have to admit, I'm still struggling to understand why people have this perception of an unfairness with engine development, when maybe some teams just did a better job than others. But there isn't that same thing with aero or suspension. Sorry, I'll translate for Birmingham for you, Summers. Aero.
Well, I mean, the issue I would take here is if I've done a terrible job on my aero, I can bring developments to my car all season long and try and fix it.
There's that.
Mercedes, for example. If I show up having finally developed a reliable powertrain, and everybody else developed an unreliable one that when they fix their reliability problems, puts them 20, 30 horsepower ahead of me. Well, I would say you're beyond at that point, the bounds within which you want power units, because it's okay to have a less powerful unit if it has advantages other places. And I think this is part of the conversation that the manufacturers are having. But at a certain point, you're just behind, and you should be allowed to fix it, just in the interest of, should we call it fair-ish play?
That's a really interesting point you brought up with the reliability, Summers. And this is a conversation we've had without you. Tell us if we're, you know, being insane here. Like, some of the teams will have basically baked in a performance level that the rest of the parts they can't handle. The easiest example would be because it overheats. And if it overheats, you then have to bring back the performance artificially to work within your thermo capacity. But then you can do a reliability only upgrade, which is the cooling, because cooling stops it overheating. And that's a reliability thing. But then what you've actually done is unlocked that performance that you baked in. So you can front load the performance and then you can do reliability things. And as an engineer, that grates me because reliability is performance.
Yeah, I mean, we saw this heavily during the back end of the V8 era when those power units engines were frozen and teams or manufacturers could come along and make reliability changes to their engines, and suddenly they had a lot more performance.
Yeah,
so
it's a
similar sort of thing. Formula One has always had that sort of baked into it, and it is there for. Some of the manufacturers to take advantage of that right now, but not to the level that they previously had.
Yeah.
And I think that's where Trumpets believes that there should be a little bit more freedom to allow for Renault to make some yardage back up on that.
If you want to recreate this at home, overclock your CPU in your PC and then let it explode, and then get a replacement CPU at your own expense. But this time, get a new cooling fan, like a bigger capacity cooling fan, and then you'll find when you overclock it, it doesn't blow up. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. Matt, last bit on you, and then I think we want to end on active aero. And we might not have time for tyres due to my waffling. sad.
Uh-huh. And you want to be a regular participant on Tech Time.
It's not going well, is it? My petition. Vote now. Keep spanners out or keep spanners in. You vote now.
There's your poll for next week.
Yeah. All right, are we done? Okay, Active Aero. Oh, hang on. We press a button. It makes a noise. There's a graphic. Oh, it's a tyre, ironically, is the graphic I picked there. Active Aero. Are we ever going to get it, Summers? There was the Williams, wasn't it, in the 80s that had the Active Aero. That's what people should Google. Mansell's Williams.
That was Active Suspension.
Oh, right. Maybe I shouldn't be on the Tech Times.
Although, technically, that was Aero because it gave them the perfect ride height.
I was right. I was wrong. And now I'm right. What a roller coaster, Summers.
Yeah, I mean, I do think this is an area where Formula One could find some low-hanging fruits from an efficiency point of view. So we're obviously talking about the green side of Formula One earlier on, and we're talking about the efficiency level of the cars themselves. So if we did venture down the active aerodynamic route, and I'm not talking about DRS here, I'm talking about other areas of the car that obviously have aerodynamic surfaces that are movable. I do believe that would offer the teams new ventures in terms of understanding how to get the best from their car, from both a downforce point of view, from a drag level point of view, and certainly drag, that is where there would probably be the biggest gains. I know there's been discussions around this in the past, and there'll be discussions about it again in the future, but there's certainly a wide scope for Formula One to take this on board, and it would actually add some road relevance. So that would be a tick in the box for the FIA, because I do believe that is an area that the road manufacturers will start to head towards over the forthcoming years.
I'm trying to imagine it in my head. So they use all their aero to fly around the corner, stuck to the ground, giving them extra grip. And then you get on the straight and it's like a transformer. It's like watching Optimus Prime as all the aero folds away and tucks in.
I was going to use a transformer as my mechanism to explain this situation for you, Spanners. You got it straight away.
Did you like my transformer transforming noise?
Yeah. I think it was a very good impression.
Fine.
Better than your Brummy impression, at least.
No, it's not. My Brummy's perfect.
I'm not getting involved in judging UK accent competition. Because if you imagine Active Aero, you're like, well, it could take many forms. The simplest and most obvious one would be just stalling your wings on the straights. But then you could run it the other direction and use it both for balancing and increasing braking performance as well into braking zones. And so how do you manage that? And then if you're going to use ride height...
So huge sails going up at the end of the straight.
Well, yeah. I mean, you can use ride height to artificially transfer more weight to the rear of the car so that you have better traction, say, out of a corner. There's a lot of different things that could be done with it. And what I wish I had right now, and I don't know, maybe Summers has a better beat on it because he's closer to the journalists that cover it on a day-to-day basis, is what exactly the FIA, and I presume, you know, with the input of the teams and Liberty, is thinking about when they say active aero.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it's going to be the first iteration of it will be something more minor. We'll see certain areas of the car have an ability to be able to be movable and have certain degrees of freedom. I think the most interesting concept that might be underplayed in some ways would be cooling, because if you think about apertures being open on the car now, that's just drag that we have to overcome. So if you close those apertures down, then you're suddenly developing something that's much less draggy. So for me, cooling would be one of the priorities. But I do think there will be an expansion. They'll start small and move outwards from there. I think it would take, you know, sort of a 10-year period for us to get to where we would expect to see it from a science fiction point of view, if you want to put it that way. You know, Spanner's transformer, for argument's sake. I don't need the noise again, though. spoiling his fun. So yeah, I think it'll be a bit of a drawn out thing, but I do think that there's very good areas on the car that it could be used to make gains and be visible to people. This is the thing as well. If we're going to do it, it needs to be visible to people. Otherwise, what's the point? It needs to have an impact, and it also needs to have an impact for the driver. You know, if he's not got any control over it, or it doesn't mean anything to him, then why are we doing it? And that's part of the optics, I think, of what we need to see from it.
Within the cost cap, Summers, this sounds like a development and cost nightmare. Are you advocating for it or against it? I've not quite figured it out.
I'm advocating for it. I mean, don't you want to see something a little bit different? You know, from a future standpoint, we've had Formula One in the same sort of arrangement for a very long time. This could add something else to it. From a development point of view, it adds a new dimension for the engineers to overcome new problems. As an engineer yourself, you know, you want to add a problem into there so that you can solve it. You know, this is something that I think would excite the people that are not excited anymore within Formula One.
Shaking heads from the young American here?
No. I'm imagining, I'm going back to the glory days of the Williams and just thinking of simple things like managing weight transfer differently. I'm also kind of laughing because I think it was 2008, 2009 that you had that technical working group to solve the problem of overtaking, and their actual suggestion was for a movable front wing to solve that problem.
Yeah. How does it solve it?
It didn't. Well, we had it in 2009 and 2010, and then it got abandoned because it didn't really work.
We had a movable front wing in 2009.
Yes.
Remind me how that worked and looked.
The upper flap of the front wing was able to be moved twice per lap by the driver.
I have no memory of that whatsoever. Did that?
And that's part of the reason why it didn't work. Because you can only use it twice a lap.
So it's not particularly memorable. But is that like, did they throw the baby out with the bathwater? Was there a core idea there?
I think fundamentally there was an idea there. However, because we had the Y250 Vortex, I know it's your favourite.
Yeah, that's my favourite Vortex, that is.
Y2K Vortex.
That kind of did put a spanner in the works. Sorry, spanners, I think that was probably the reason why it wasn't as successful as it should have been and kind of got chucked out quite quickly. However, a lot of the drivers were using it to rebalance the car as well. So, you know, it became a tool for the drivers in some respects into certain corners, but it wasn't really ever that helpful because they only could do it twice a lap. And twice a lap means, oh, well, I've moved it once and now it's in a position I don't want it in. So I'll move it back to the position it was in before. And that was it kind of thing. So obviously we had DRS come off the back of it, which was more successful than the movable front flap. But again, there was a lot of money spent developing those concepts to make that work as well. And I think there was a lot of Formula One engineers that were annoyed at the fact that they'd had to construct certain front wing end plate designs to make it work. And then it just suddenly went away.
As you would be. But then I'm suddenly thinking, like, if we really had the ability to manipulate the front wing, I mean, with whatever parameters you initially design it for in terms of flaps and main planes, but you could theoretically then just have a single front wing that's adjustable that could cover everything from Monza to Monaco.
That sounds like a speedway front wing.
Wouldn't that be wild?
I have a future thing that's kind of along these lines, something fundamentally different, especially as we move more towards electric stuff. Could we have four independently driven wheels? So each one's got its own little electric motor and, like, you can basically turn 90 degrees. Is that stupid? Like, you're both laughing. How dumb is that?
That's literally torque vectoring.
Yeah.
is that good? I don't know. What you said didn't clarify whether what I said was stupid or not.
Look, it can be done.
It can be done.
But aren't we talking about Formula One and not Formula E here?
Is there going to be a difference long term? They're going to merge, aren't they? They have to at some point.
Well, I'd hope it's in a distant future based on how we're currently set up in Formula One versus how we're currently set up in Formula E. But yeah, at some point, I guess there must be some kind of
convergence. So hang on. So you're allowed to turn the cars into Optimus Prime, but I'm not allowed to have independently driven wheels, or even just like as an assist for grip or whatever. You know, you have your main engine driving the rear wheels, and then you've got little motors driving the front wheels.
World Endurance Championship had that with the LMP1s, I believe.
Get in. I'm a visionary. Or I nicked it from LMP1. I can't remember which.
But part of the driver's skill in Formula One has always been it's fundamentally a rear wheel drive driven formula. And as that is a fact, it is even cashiered taking energy off the front axle, not even using it on the front axle, because they're so worried about, what would you call it, branding, Summers?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it is rear-wheel drive. Formula One has always, well, not always, but fundamentally, we're a rear-wheel drive series,
right,
aren't we? So to suddenly depart from that, I think then you're treading into different waters, but it is a possibility, Span, as you are, from an engineering point of view, it's possible.
Okay.
If it's Formula One, I'm not sure on that level, because it was talked about as well.
Was it? Okay, so not so
in
dumb.
Framing the next set of regulations.
Yeah. So there's a battle here between wanting to make Formula One a place of engineering excellence and of pushing and driving technology forward, maybe even being a leader in technology rather than a technology taker. But then the other side of the coin is, why not just strip it back? Like, if the racing is really important, you could still challenge the engineers by giving them less to work with, by taking away a lot of those toys. The best engineers would still produce the best car, but at less cost and with smaller gaps. So I say, let's go the other way. Let's go caveman. Take the engines out. Have them Fred Flintstone legs at the bottom of the ground mat. That's the other philosophy they could go down with the regs.
Yeah, we call that IndyCar, I think.
Right.
Or Super Formula, maybe. No, the engineers that are there now would probably disagree with you about simplifying the sport even more. I think we're beginning to get to a limit for certain engineers as to whether or not they'll bother to stick around, because they're more engaging, complex problems for them to solve elsewhere. The problem you have, and I think, you know, this is what we are essentially talking about, part of what we define Formula One as is having way too much horsepower for the rear axle and requiring driver skill to manage it. And then the other problem is we want to, without bankrupting every team in the sport, give the engineers as much creativity and freedom as possible to help the drivers manage that problem. And it is a pendulum, and it gets pushed back and forth.
Comment, yeah, Mr. I mean, Summerfield.
That's obviously the problem from an engineering point of view. The teams want to be involved in an engineering project, which is what Formula One offers, aside from filtering a huge amount of money out of their parent companies as well along the way for tax purposes, perhaps. But that fundamentally, that's what these players are here for. You know, they want the engineering challenge alongside the sporting aspect that goes with it. And it's a fine line that has to be trod by every single part of the Formula One community as a whole. And sometimes we get it right because the regulations permit that, and other times we don't get it right. And unfortunately, you know, the battle between the engineering side and the sporting side just rub up against one another. So I think it's always going to be a bit of a dance between the two. At the moment, I think we're kind of in some of that middle ground, but we do perhaps need a little bit of a shift towards the sporting side to engage a more competitive grid.
Okay, the show is effectively over in so much as that is the tech content that we wanted to talk about. And we will give Matt another opportunity to come in with his tire chat. Like, don't worry. But now I want to get to meet the panel. And this is non-canon. This is optional. You can opt out. If you want to go, click the links in the show notes below. Look at me. Yeah, put your hand up at the back of the class if you need to leave early. But go and follow Summers at SummersF1 on Twitter and Matt at MattPT55 on Twitter as well, or on X. And make sure you follow them because they've got great content most of the time. But this is the Meet the Panel segment. So I can highlight the not so great content that Matthew Summerfield does put on Twitter, which is very much golf related. So I want to start by talking to Matthew Summerfield about your obsession, because you are obsessed with golf, and I am so jealous. I had to pack in golf under spousal pressure around the birth of our second child. No, when my daughter was born, that's it. That was just the last straw. I lost my gaming, had a little gaming room, which she needed just to sleep in. That was lame. And the time I would spend on the golf course built up a resentment when I came home. It wasn't worth it. But you're obsessed with it, Summers, and you're out there like having this resurgence, this second life in golf. And I'm happy to see you happy and happy to see your scores coming down on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a bit of a journey, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I played when I was a lot younger, when I was a teenager, and kind of fell out of love with it. And obviously life takes over and you end up doing Formula One stuff, and that takes up a lot of your time. But got to a point where COVID came along, and obviously that changed things, and that's where I got back into golf. And as you say, I'm not obsessed.
Yes, you are. Hang on. Can we just, let's take a vote. Hands up on the panel if Summers is obsessed with golf. That's my hand's gone up, and Trumpet's hand is going up as well. So yes, unfortunately, you've lost that one. Why do you think you're not obsessed? Like, I don't think it's even a bad thing. Like, because I've seen the improvement as well from the stats, and I caught you and I had a round with you during your like improvement learning phase, and you were taking the learning very, very seriously. To the point, like, each putt took about 5 minutes as you were lining up the ball and taking your stance and everything.
I think that you over-egg how long it was taking
Eight
for me to do those
minutes per putts.
No. Anyway,
I actually messaged him before that round and explained that of all the things that would drive you nuts, taking forever over putts was the thing that would send you over the edge.
You egged him on. Because I know I'm going to miss anyway, but you had so much hope in your eyes with every putt.
Well, yeah, but that was the foundation for my improvements. You know, to put it into context, I've gone from a 25.3 handicap to a 10.5.
That's amazing.
That's no
that's
small
amazing.
Feat in the space of time.
No. Go
it.
Ahead, mention your short game handicap now.
No, it's not a short game handicap, but my strokes gained for short game is very, very good. Let's put it like past scratch level.
Right.
According to Arcos.
So scratch means you play, like, you don't need a handicap score, so that's the level you need to be to enter proper competitions. So golf is frustrating. Like, we all play golf here. I think Matt plays golf as well. But I see golf as two very distinct games. So you've got off the tee and the fairway, and then the getting onto the green and getting into the pointlessly small hole. So I can, and when my drive is in, you know, in practice, not when I played you, I hadn't played for about 3 or 4 years. But normally my whole thing was I could dump the ball 250 yards, which is more than most people who tip up at a tee. And I could swing the big stick. But when it got to the green, I just felt like it was impossible. I think golf would be better if the hole was the size of like a garbage bin, a dustbin. Putting should be a completely different game for like 100-year-old people.
So you want a foot golf hole?
Yeah.
On the golf course.
Do you know, a lot of golf courses, now the pitch and putts have been replaced with foot golf. And that's happened at my local. I wanted to take my kid for a pitch and putt. And they're like, oh no, it's foot golf now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a growing sport, isn't it? So I think that from a shared point of view in terms of property, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
Just opens things up to a different age range as well. You know, golf is a sport that is generally played by the older generation, let's say.
Yeah.
I actually played a course one time with my daughter that did have manhole size
nice
holes for her to putt at. I still had to putt them at the teeny tiny hole. But those courses exist. You can take
I
your
like
kids
that.
To with like giant holes for them to putt the ball into. It's fantastic. Well, I actually cheated and used hers.
Yeah, it's not even for the kids, Summers. That would be less frustrating. We could play around together and you wouldn't have to wait for my 8 putts per hole. I can just put it into the bin-shaped hole. But what I love about you and your golf, Summers, is because it would come as no surprise to anyone, like you took a very analytical approach to your improvement.
Yeah, I mean, highly data-driven. From a strokes game point of view, I run a spreadsheet, believe it or not, with every single round that I've ever had.
I do believe you.
That spreadsheet.
No one is sitting at home going, oh, I can't believe that. Everyone believes it.
My glimpse tracker, as I call it, it gives me hope that I could possibly play to that level. And I think it's a big part of my improvement. But as you say, yeah, data's been a big part. I'm currently re-engaging in a speed training regimen. Because as you get older, you lose speed, and that means you lose distance. And obviously, I'm not the most sprightly person anymore, although my brain thinks it is.
How
my
old
body
are you,
doesn't
Summers?
Agree.
How old are you?
42.
So you're still the youngest person on this panel, sadly. But yeah, I can relate to you. I went swimming today, and I normally like to swim for an hour. After 25 minutes, my knee, it sent a polite request to knock things on the head, which I ignored. And after 40 minutes, it was like a demand. It's like, no, we have had enough today. We will stop for the day. So you're not physically limited at golf, surely?
I do have issues sometimes with my back.
Oh, yeah, me too.
But that's an old injury that reoccurs, and same with a knee injury. But, you know, that's just life, isn't it? And I am trying to become fitter and...
Oh, so you're doing some cardio? You're getting some cardio going?
Yeah, I'm using, you know, yoga and stretching and all that sort of good stuff to try to improve my body for golf, nothing else.
But that's good. That's good to know you're in yoga. Why don't we get any, risque yoga poses on your Twitter instead of just your golf shots? That's what I'm looking forward to next.
Summer's nobody yoga. Wants to see that. Nobody wants to see that.
Email feedback at mistake. No, don't. With subject line, yoga poses.
See, I can't believe you're asking him about the new golf balls that are being restricted for distance.
Oh, yeah. No, well, I always wondered about that because golf courses take up so much land. And I think this seems like a sensible approach. So professional golf is now making the standard golf ball less long hittable. Do you approve?
Well, it's not coming in straight away. There is a lead time before we see that golf ball appear. However, I do understand where they're coming from because pros themselves are getting longer. You know, the average driving distance has gone up. I think it's by about 15 yards in the past decade. So it doesn't sound like a lot, but obviously it does have an impact on how far the individuals are driving the ball, and that is average. So the longest hitters are obviously hitting it much further. Yeah. I mean, you only have to think of DeChambeau or Rory McIlroy to think about long hitters. And there's others obviously that are coming out of the woodwork now, which can go just as far as those guys. So yeah, I mean, I understand where they're coming from, but from an amateur level point of view, we need less distance, because we don't hit it that far. And this is going to be a global thing where everybody is going to be playing those golf balls because that's what the R&A and the USGA have decided. And it will have an impact on amateurs, obviously not as large an impact as the pros, but it will have an impact. And we need more distance, not less.
I have to say, I've always been at this kind of disadvantage because there's two factors here, right? A, I'm cheap. So I only go for like the pond balls that have been fished out of lakes, and people sell them on eBay. And the other thing is, because of my slice, I lose maybe 5 or 6 golf balls a round. So I can't afford the like your Titleist anyway. So I've always been at this disadvantage. So yes, bring on the less good golf balls. But Summers, have you considered setting up like a Summers Golf Twitter? Because I heard that you and Matt were planning a golf walk around podcast at one point.
We've talked about having a podcast. We've talked about several things. I have actually got a separate Twitter account for golf.
Have you?
I've got a YouTube channel.
Have for golf?
Well.
What's the Twitter? Tell us that. We'll link it in the show notes as well.
I can't remember. I never post there, Spanners, because what's the point in having all these different accounts?
Well, then
might as well just have one.
Well, then why would we don't follow Summers on his golf account? Right. I'm glad we've got an insight into your soul.
I've got a YouTube channel. I'll give you the link for
that. Okay, good. Go and follow Summers Golf.
People can watch me play golf. There you go. That'll get them involved.
And if the demand is high enough, also watch him doing yoga. It might sound like I've just zoned in on Summer's golf in his life and I've not taken an interest in any other aspect of his life, but trust me, it is very much all about golf at the moment. We have just dived in and grabbed his soul. And if we were going to try and hold the soul of a freelance musician like Matt Trumpets is, we would probably need a whiskey glass. Now, there are some people out there who might be confused as to why I call you Matt Trumpets, but it is actually just because I'm unimaginative of giving out nicknames and you played trumpet and I wasn't sure whether on the first shows whether you wanted me to use your surname. So I couldn't remember it. So I just said Matt Trumpets. But you're an actual trumpet player for money. And yes. Like in the same way that my wife is a working musician, most musicians have to teach around that. But it's so strange being a musician that you have to be so good, work so hard, practice so much, beat off a lot of competition to earn, actually, it's relatively...
barely anything.
Relatively little money to bring so much joy. Like, everybody wants music all the time. It's got to be one of the most and least rewarding avenues of profession that there are.
Yeah, well, I mean, at its best, you are at the absolute limit of your mind and body's ability to do something. You are 100% engaged. And there's when you get there, when you like you hit that point, there's nothing better. It's magic. It only happens. It's a very rare occurrence. Most of the time, yeah, like we talk about Formula One. I love this. Most of the time, it's like a Grand Prix. You're just managing.
Yes,
you're managing your resources to make the notes, to make the thing happen. But every now and then, you just pick up the horn and you're like, oh, everything just works. And when you combine that with a good group or in front of a huge audience, like tens of thousands of people, it's wild. I can't even describe the feeling of it.
Wait, like, how many
how
people?
How rewarding it is to be people? Able to do that.
Why?
Tens of thousands.
When have you played tens of thousands of people?
I think the biggest audience I ever played for was at the US Open, the tennis tournament, the US Open.
Yeah.
I played at they have a standard. They do a musical performance before the women's final. And I performed it that one year. It was the year of, the hurricane in New Orleans that drowned it. And I remember this because they actually changed the music. Idina Menzel was there. She sang. And it started out with When the Saints Go Marching In and kind of like a taps fade. And it was aired live on CBS. So I was playing for, hundreds of millions, if not close to a billion people who were watching.
Nice.
That.
Wow. That is
center court. Center court. Yeah.
That is like, that's proper.
2005. Katrina. That was the hurricane. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, that is like proper, like I'm trying to explain to people, you're not just somebody who like has learned to play the trumpet and plays at home. Like you're a proper trumpet player. And
yeah. No, I went to conservatory. In fact, one of my favorites.
Explain
stories.
That. Explain that. You can't just go past that. You went to
conservatory.
What?
That's like a finishing school for musicians. It's where you go if you want to be a professional musician.
Okay,
so
we
I went
are...
to Manhattan School of Music.
Right, so it's a posh music school.
Well, it's not. It's posh, but it's what you know. Because one of the things we do talk about is meritocracy a lot, and advantage aside in terms of having lessons and stuff like that. When you show up to audition for a place like Manhattan School, I played for. The principal trumpet of the New York Philharmonic, the guy who played it for like 35 years, William Vacchiano, current principal of the Met at the time, Mel Broyles, who played over 40 years as principal trumpet, and so on and so forth, down the line of national and internationally renowned musicians. And you just walk in and they say, okay, play something for us. And you say, okay, and you play it. And they say, play this. And you say, okay. And they say, play that. And you do that. And you do one more. And they say, okay, thank you very much. And then you're either in or you're out.
Mm.
And I think they admitted 12 people the year I got into Manhattan School out of, around 800 people who applied. It was pretty long odds. And I still can't quite believe that I played well enough to get in. It surprised me a great deal. But it just So when you go there, it's your life is about music. You play an orchestra, you take lessons, you go to classes, music theory, music history. It's literally you spend those years of your life just fully immersed in doing music.
Mm.
And then you get out and you have to make money. So, you know, you do whatever you can.
But it's just like Summers, you've seen, you know, these guys at a karting event, you know, and it just makes the whole room turn. And go, and just for the amount of joy it brings, it is just such an undervalued profession. And the reason I try and kind of big up like your background to people listening is, like, for example, at the karting event, everyone knows, oh, you play trumpet, oh, you get your trumpet out. As soon as like you and my wife start, you know, playing, but the trumpet is so striking that people are like, oh no, he plays the trumpet. Anyone can buy a trumpet and press the buttons.
It's interesting because as with anything, I think you can sort of lose perspective on yourself. Like I know what I'm good at. I know what advantage. I know what I was really good at. What I am really good at. I know the groups that I play with that I've always enjoyed playing with. The stuff that I like to do. But every now and then, like when I just pick something up and play, and you just see the looks on people's faces, you're like, oh yeah, right, yeah, this is actually something that. That people are impressed by, that it's because it is, you know, it's a skill that's easily replicated electronically. You know, I suspect a lot of people would have a hard time telling the difference listening to a recording if it was synth patches or real live instruments. But when you pull an instrument out and you play right in front of somebody, they're like, oh, I get the difference now. And it can be pretty dramatic. I've had some amazing nights playing with amazing, I mean, truly amazing, amazing musicians. The group that I play with now that, you know, that I'm flogging on the show a bit, the Ska Orchestra, New York City Ska Orchestra. Some of the best musicians I've ever played. Like, it, literally, I sit there and I can't believe they're like, oh yeah, you're a part of this too. It's an amazing and fun group. But I will end with, I don't know, I went to a Wynton Marsalis masterclass, and he talked about his first year when he signed all of his contracts, and he was flying all over the world and staying in these hotels. And he's like, yeah, he says, but ask me how much money I actually made that year. he says, I didn't really make that much money. He says, but I never let anyone think that I didn't, yep. Which I kind of love. But I remember playing, I did a stint with the Four Tops back in the 90s where they would pick me up when they came to the Northeast. They had three trumpets. They had like a 10 horn section. And I would play third trumpet with them because I was friends with the guy who played second trumpet, who was friends with the guy who contracted the orchestra, which is also kind of how it works in music. But I remember playing up at a casino. They had like this round gaming floor, and in the very center of it, they had the stage where we were performing. And the first night we had a sound check, we had a rehearsal. So I got there was nobody there, went up on stage, played, just, you know, packed audience. But the second night it was just, you know, show up an hour before the show. And so I show up and I got my little credentials and do the, you know, park my beater car with the and walk in, and there's this huge line all the way to the edge of the gaming floor and beyond, double line. I walk all the way up to the front of it, and I realize that it's the line to get in to see our show. And I said, but our show, I mean the Four Tops. they could have cared less about me. There's 20 trumpet players who could have been me right there. It just happened to be me. And there are these two giant guys in a red velvet robe. And one of them looked up at me, saw my credentials, and said, in you go, sir, and opened that velvet robe. And I got to walk in. I thought, man, this is it. This is the highlight of my career, just getting to walk past all these people and get in there. Yeah. It wasn't the only highlight of my career. But
no, that's
yeah,
the
you
only
get some
highlight.
Magic moments like that, and it's really special. It's hard to beat.
This is it. You know, you've chosen sometimes in your life, in your career, you can choose the glory or you can choose the money. So, for example, a lot of F1 engineers, they could easily earn more money like working in the defense industry. There's a lot of crossover between especially like the aerodynamicists. there. And so, like, having worked in the defence industry, there's loads of guys who go, oh, yeah, no, that's my mate, works for such and such a team. Oh, why didn't you go and do something like that? Oh, you know, paying bills and eating food. But, you know, really, Matt, you've messed up. You know, you look at the two of us and you could have been a freelance bum presenter or a F1 tech journalist and just be raking in the million summers. I assume being an F1 tech journalist is one of the wealthiest trades on earth.
Oh, yeah, of course it is. Yeah. I'm absolutely rolling in it.
Do you know, but this is it. You two are in, both of you, in underappreciated art forms is what I think. And I hope, though, that the patrons and the panelists and the listeners out there will appreciate getting to know these guys a little bit more. Click all the links and follow them in the show notes below. And if you think this winter nonsense we're providing you is of value, why not consider supporting us at patreon.com/missedapex. We have plans afoot for the rest of the off season. We have Uncle Steve Amy, teaming up with Christian Pedersen to do the history of F1 broadcasting and the future of F1 broadcasting. And there's plenty of time to get the rest of the panel in as well. But some medium exciting news if you're into Formula E. Look out on Monday. Look out on my social media. You should be following me anyway. I'm the best one. At Spanners Ready and Richard Ready on all the platforms. Look out for our brand new Formula E podcast that is going to be launched just in time for the start of the season. So Monday evening, that Formula E podcast will be out. But until we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast. Be honest. I've turned it all off now, I promise. Can I be on Tech Time for 2024? Like, just tell me what you really think. No one's listening. You don't have to be kind. Just let me know.
I want a 5,000-word essay on tyres, and then we might consider it.
No, I'm out. 5,000 words? I can barely write my own name. I sign with an X, and you want me to write
audio.
An essay?
It could be audio.
Have you heard me speaking on this podcast about tech? So I'll be the first thing about tyres is that they are round and they are good. And it's good that they are round and I like tyres.
I am sorry we did not get to the sidewall topic, because if we are really going to smaller tyres, I'm very interested as to the profile of the sidewalls, because that can make a huge difference in the handling of the car.
Yeah, I'm pretty glad we didn't get to the sidewall topic. Who are you getting arrested? It always sounds like you're getting arrested in the background.
New York.
It's because, do you know what it is? As a trumpet player, you're stealing a living. That's what it is, you bum. And they're coming to get you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.